Okay, we got Spencer Graves here and Gordon Elliott, and we've got a great show lined up for you today on internet, net neutrality, and all kinds of stuff like that. Spencer, take it away.
Okay, you are listening to Radioactive Magazine, 90.1 FM KKFI. The opinions you are about to hear are those of the hosts and guests and do not reflect the official position of KKFI, Midcoast Radio Project, nor management staff and volunteers. I'm Spencer Graves, your host for this episode of Radioactive Magazine. Tom Crane is at the controls. Gordon Elliott is here to discuss net neutrality, moderated by Tom. But first, we want to talk about the primaries in Kansas and Missouri. Although, let me just get a brief announcement that net neutrality will be discussed further at a forum organized by the Friends of Community Media Saturday, August 5th, 4 to 5:30 at the KKFI Annex, 3901 Main Street in Kansas City, Missouri. You can park and enter in the back. Next Tuesday, August 1st, primaries will be held for a variety of local offices in Kansas and some, but perhaps not all, Kansas jurisdictions. Kansas voters can get sample ballots from their county elections office. On the web, you can search for election office with the name of your county. My ballot, I live at roughly Metcalf and on 435 in Overland Park, and my ballot includes only one race, and that's for a seat on the board of the Shawnee Mission School District. I know that parts of Merriam, Kansas, have a contested race for a city council seat. You need to check to see your vote counts more in local elections than they would in national elections. In any case, if you're registered to vote in Kansas but will not be able to go to the polls on August 1st, you can vote in person at the county election office. In Missouri, the following Tuesday, August 8th, there will be elections in many Missouri jurisdictions. The Kansas City, Missouri ballot will include three initiative questions. The first one is adamantly opposed to streetcar expansion, requiring voter approval before the city can spend any more money or time considering streetcar expansion. The second would provide funding for it. I would be surprised if both pass. The third question asks Kansas City voters to approve an increase in the minimum wage to $15 per hour. This is being requested especially by Stand Up KC, which is a local incarnation of the National Fight for 15 movement. The Facebook page for Stand Up KC is announcing a Faith, Justice, and Action Dinner this coming Thursday, July 27th, at St. Mark's Hope and Peace Lutheran Church. The debate on minimum wage is the same today as it has been for probably every minimum wage question in history. The conservatives insist that people will lose jobs because many businesses, especially small businesses, will not be able to afford to pay their higher wages. People supporting an increase in the minimum wage claim that increasing the minimum wage will actually boost the economy because poor people will have more money to spend and will spend it. There actually has been a moderate amount of research on this question, far more, I think, than most people believe, and far more than you might find from perusing the mainstream media. Wikipedia articles on minimum wage and minimum wage in the United States summarize the available research. The minimum wage is different in different jurisdictions, which create opportunities for natural experiments. Different studies have reached surprisingly different conclusions, although the vast majority of studies have found that the impact on unemployment is small to non-existent within the range of a practical of experience. In 1933, President Franklin Roosevelt signed legislation setting the minimum wage at 25 cents an hour, but that was overturned by the Supreme Court in 1935. The Congress came back in 1938 with the Fair Labor Standards Act that included a 25 cent an hour minimum wage, which the Supreme Court in 1941 decided was constitutional. That 25 cents adjusted for inflation is $4 in today's money. $4 an hour, all right? Moreover, that 1938 minimum wage was roughly equivalent to the average annual income, gross domestic product per capita at the time, which I think is an important benchmark. Since 1938, the minimum wage has been eroded by inflation, but has been increased many times by legislation. Adjusted for inflation, it peaked in 1968 at roughly $11 an hour in today's money. Between 1938 and 68, the average annual income was increasing slightly faster than the minimum wage. And the 1968 minimum wage was only 88% of the average, less as a percentage of the average income than in 1938. This meant that the nation could more easily afford the increase in 1968 than in 1938. But the same average income does not account for income inequality. To understand income inequality, it's helpful to look at the median income, 50% or below and 50% are above the median, and compare that with the average. Census data about the median on the median family income began in 1947. From that date until around 1970, the median family income grew at roughly the same rate as the average. Since 1970, the average has more than doubled, but the median has increased roughly only 25%. The gap is now roughly $40,000 a year for the typical American family. If we round that down to $36,500, we see that the gap is roughly $100 a day for the typical American family. Part of the explanation for that gap is that increases in the minimum wage have not kept pace with inflation and certainly have not kept pace with productivity growth. Nationwide, the minimum wage now stands at roughly, averages roughly $7.25 an hour, down considerably from the $11 per hour and $2015 that it was in 1968. Doubling the minimum wage from 7.25 to basically 15 would bring it up to only 56% of the average, still far below the 88% of the average that it was in 1968. For more information, oh, and by the way, Stephanie Kelton, who was Bernie Sanders' chief economist, told me that the United States has never had an inflation driven by consumer demand. Our inflations have been driven by the oil price hike, OPEC, and in the mid-70s, and by war prior to World War II. For more information on this, I recommend the Wikipedia article on income inequality in the U.S., as well as the articles previously mentioned on minimum wage and minimum wage in the U.S., or check the description of this episode on Radioactive Magazine at kkfi.org that includes links and others. Those links and others. Let me turn now one more comment about elections. You need to bring appropriate proof of identity. Last November, Missouri voters approved by 63% to 37% a constitutional amendment requiring a voter ID to vote. That seems to have been based on a widely held belief promoted by conservatives and media like Fox that the nation has a major problem with vote fraud by people who are not legally eligible to vote. If you have solid evidence to support this belief, I want to know. I've looked for it. I cannot find it. Everything I've seen says that there is not a substantive problem with people voting who are not eligible to vote that could be fixed by requiring photo IDs to vote. For example, the Secretary of State of Kansas, Chris Kobach, is the only Secretary of State in the nation authorized to prosecute this kind of vote fraud. He received that authority in 2015 after claiming for 4 years that Kansas had a massive problem with voter fraud that the local and state prosecutors were not adequately addressing. At that time, he said he had identified more than 100 possible cases of double voting. By February 7th of this year, Kobach had filed 9 cases and obtained 6 convictions. Moreover, all those 6 cases involved double voting which could not have been prevented by the voter ID laws passed in Kansas and Missouri. So the voter ID laws, by the evidence that I've been able to find, solve no problem except one, all right? And that is the voting by likely Democratic voters. Because it would appear that the primary drive of all of this is voter suppression. That's real. In 1980, Republican strategist Paul Weyrich famously said, "I don't want everybody to vote. Our leverage in elections goes up as the voting populace goes down." Since 1981, the Republican National Committee has been hauled into court on numerous occasions by the Democratic National Committee in order to cease and desist from voter caging and similar voter suppression techniques. They keep doing this and getting away with it, I guess, because the mainstream media, especially mainstream commercial broadcasters, believe they would make more money by largely suppressing reports on this issue. This is a special case of a more general problem that progress on every substantive issue I can think of is blocked because every plausible countermeasure threatens someone with substantive control over the media. Most people still get their news from commercial television. This is a problem, especially since between 1975 and 2000, the mainstream commercial broadcasters fired nearly all of their real investigative journalists, except for a few with popular programs like 60 Minutes. This was great for business because it reduced the risks of exposing problems and special favors that big major advertisers get from government that they did not want in the public eye. No business I know thrives by biting the hands that feed them, and the media organizations do not want to bite the hands that feed them. Just a reminder for those of who just joined us, you're listening to Radioactive Magazine, 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. We've been discussing the primary elections, August 1st in Kansas and August 8th in Missouri. We now turn to the primary issue for tonight's show, net neutrality. That's the principle that all traffic on the Internet should be treated equally by telecommunications services like Comcast, Verizon, AT&T, and Spectrum, formerly Time Warner Cable. They do not want net neutrality. They want to be able to charge websites extra for delivering their content to the end users at the high speeds that have now become standard. Net neutrality also threatens the major media, which means that anyone can currently compete in the marketplace of ideas based solely on the quality of their presentation. With that extended introduction, I'd like to mention the Forum on Net Neutrality, the Friends of Community Media will host 11 days from now on August 5th, 4 to 5:30 p.m. at the KKFI Annex, 2901 Main Street, Kansas City, Missouri, parking and entrance in the rear. We also discussed net neutrality at our previous forum, July 15th, which included a video conference with Ernesto Falcón, an attorney and legislative counsel with the Electronic Frontier Foundation in San Francisco. And we are now, can we go to that six-minute interview, Tom, with Falcón?
Yeah, I was just looking for it here on the system, and I need to know the name of it. I looked under Falcón.
No. It's under the name, I think it's Radioactive Magazine. I think it's probably what you started playing.
Okay. There's a Radioactive Magazine, which
has today's date on it, right?
Yeah. Okay, here we go.
The following is an interview with Ernesto Falcón, an attorney and legislative counsel for the Electronic Frontier Foundation, which is one of the leading citizen advocacy groups specializing in the law of the Internet. I'm Spencer Graves, a journalist with 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. This interview was recorded Thursday, July 12, 2017. Mr. Falcón, without referring people to your website, EFF.org, could you please tell our listeners what you would like the public to do about the current Federal Communication Commission's Notice of Proposed Rulemaking on Restoring Internet Freedom, which is the freedom of major telecommunications companies like Comcast and AT&T to censor our Internet usage?
We're kind of approaching it in a number of ways. We're trying to activate the public so that they make their voice heard. We're filing our own, the attorneys at EFF are filing our own legal brief in terms of the issues and the impacts on the policy decisions that are being made and whether those are fit within the context of the law.
Yep.
And we're, you know, trying to activate as many kind of technologists and folks who, you know, who are involved in the actual building and running of the internet to weigh in with the regulator, because there are a different set of experts that are necessary to talk. So those are all the things we're doing, kind of like in a real quick summary. You know, the hope would be that, you know, the small businesses, the small internet service providers, and just the general activism around this space will make it clear the politics on this is very much one-sided. You know, Chairman Pai wouldn't proceed, and if he does proceed, you know, then it's a different posture at that point. Then we have to fight, you know, we're probably going to have to fight it out in the courts, you know, at the end of the day.
Do you have any specific suggestions regarding possible contents of official comments?
No one has to be an attorney to file comments to the FCC. All the FCC really needs is, you know, why are the rules important to them as they stand today? So, like, the rules of non-discrimination, no blocking, no throttling, and neutrality generally. Why is that important today? What is the impact on them if those rules were removed? What's the harm that would occur? And then general, you know, piece of what the FCC should do, which is, you know, I would suspect, you know, stay the course. Don't change the underlying, you know, a legally enforceable regime of net neutrality. You know, don't abandon that in hopes of the major ISPs kind of behaving nicely.
I've heard that if comments are filed in a certain way, the FCC is required to pay more attention to them.
Yeah, in the sense of the format would be, it needs to be concrete, you know, concretely, you know, kind of going over the way I just talked about it. You know, you're explaining, I'm a local business or a local, you know, organization or you know, or what have you. You know, you're impacted by the law, and the change in the law would have the following, you know, adverse consequences to me to do what I do, whether it's commercial product or some sort of other, like, organization or mobilization tools or, you know, kind of whatever they do that depends on the internet and depends on the openness of the internet to be successful. So that's the stuff that gets attention, because the FCC has to respond to the concerns in its order by explaining how, you know, it's in the public's interest to do what they're doing. And then you know, the bulk of the major numbers of comments are, you know, come from average citizens who just want a free and open internet and make it very clear in, you know, one, two sentences. Don't mess the rules, leave them the way they're at under Title II. I support neutrality, right? So those, the chairman has already indicated he will give less attention to, which is unfortunate. I think that's really kind of a disservice for, in terms of his job as a public servant. But, you know, that's what they're doing, and at the end of the day, this is a matter of the administrative agency and how it's supposed to, you know, work with the public. Probation in Kansas City, correct?
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, the most fundamentally important thing for you guys in the state of Kansas is the senator that's your representative in Congress, Senator Moran. You know, I think he's a Republican that understands the importance of the internet openness, but he's also sympathetic to the ISP. So he just needs to hear a lot from people in the state of Kansas saying, you know, I like net neutrality and the rules that exist today. Please don't change it. As my senator, what are you doing to protect my interests? I've long worked with his office in the past, and I think he's someone who really understands the importance of innovation and openness and kind of internet freedom on a very different level than I think many other politicians do.
Great.
You know, my hope would be everyone locally, you know, kind of activates and makes those calls, so that you have two senators and a member of the House that are pretty critical, because, you know, they have a lot more of a say. The Missouri delegation also is just as important, I think, on this one. But in terms of the Senator Moran in Kansas, the reason why he's kind of unique is also he's also a lead senator on telecommunications policy. He sits on the Committee of Direct Oversight over the Federal Communications Commission, so he has a lot more of a direct say. People need to take it to the next step, which is plan to meet your elected officials, your two senators and member of the House, you know, in the coming week, and be very active, because it's only through mobilization that we're going to win this.
Yeah,
All right. So that was comments from Ernesto Falcone of the Electronic Frontier Foundation. If you're concerned about this issue, I suggest you use the internet to do your own research. There's a great website, battleforthenet.com, that provides the easiest way I know for people to send comments to the Federal Communications Commission and simultaneously their elected representatives in the U.S. House and Senate.
And we were really privileged to have them on to our net neutrality forum a couple weeks ago.
Exactly right. And by the way, his 28 minutes of his presentation at that, you heard just now 6 minutes of that presentation. 28 minutes will be played, essentially half an hour will be played a week from this coming Thursday. I guess it's on August 3rd on KKFI at 9:30 a.m. So in any case, why don't we go to...
Yeah, we got Gordon Elliott here, who's been with in the IT field for many years and knows a lot about the history of the Internet. So, hey, Gordon, welcome.
Yeah, hi. This is a new experience for me. I've done a lot of design of the equipment on the other end of this microphone, and now I'm looking down a microphone that's something I've worked on for years and years and years and just never experienced from this end. So I'm having a great time with an interesting experience. Spencer and I, as part of an organization, Friends of Community Media, and with assistance of other people, filed our own comment on the net neutrality with the Federal Communications Commission, and that was a very interesting experience for me.
That was a week ago Monday, wasn't it?
Yeah, we got finished like 2 hours before the cutoff deadline, or maybe 1 hour before finalizing edits and all, just because we were a little behind the ball on getting everything done. I mean, that's the way it works with a volunteer organization.
Well, it was an amazing piece of work, and if anybody wants to see it, they can go to the website, ourfcm.org. And there's a news release there about it, and you can click on the bottom and see. Well, how many pages was it? Was it like...
I think it was six.
Yeah, we edited it down, and I've got a copy.
I had
a copy, and it was eight the way I thought it was filed.
But. Yeah, anyway, it was quite an extensive document. It's very well done, and, you know, refuted what the FCC is trying to do right now, which is... to kind of kill this thing called net neutrality, which is a word that maybe folks don't understand. But
Right. It basically means that all traffic should be treated the same on the Internet. The big telecommunications companies want to charge extra for delivering content at the, quote, at the high speeds that are basically become standard that everybody expects. If they do that, it will, according to a lot of folks, it will stifle investment in and a lot of the internet startups, the small companies, in favor of the big companies that can pay, and small companies that use the internet to advertise will have to pay extra if they want.
And this is kind of a part of a larger picture, which is what Friends of Community Media is trying to address, in the ownership of a very few giant companies. By over 95% of the media are owned by these, like Sinclair Broadcasting and some of the other giant mega corporations, which is really scary because they can start censoring what goes on the Internet.
Correct. And that's one of my major concerns.
Well, there's more than censoring. One of the major concerns has been the speed of delivery and things like that. But 'cause my experience has been in development of electronic circuits, like I mentioned, working on radio station equipment. We built radio station equipment that looks awfully close to the way internet switches work and things like that, using all kinds of complex logic. And there's been this tremendous change from in the last 30 years, especially in the last 10 of those years, of the amount of, let's call it intelligence, but it's not intelligence like you think of in the science fiction movies that you see, where it's just complex logic. But you can put complex logic into to do things where you affect the speed, give priorities, all kinds of things that the user may not even know that a source material has been discriminated against, because they still see the source material. It just, well, if it's audio, maybe it's corrupted. If it's video, well, maybe it pauses. And you might tend to blame, well, the source material is, they don't have a good delivery system.
And it could well be that the major telecoms are precisely discriminated against them, so forth. So the episode description for this episode on at kkfi.org under Radioactive Magazine also includes some instructions about how you can comment if you want to, and how you can places where you can get more information about this. As I mentioned before, battleforthenet.com. There are also ways to send comments directly to the FCC and their elected officials. There are two different types of comments that can be submitted, so-called express comments from individuals, and they've received something close to 12 million comments like that so far. And then there are so-called standard filings that are used by organizations like the Friends of Community Media, and I also filed one myself under the name of effectivedefense.org. Where in the latter one I made especially, I had two arguments. One was based on the First Amendment of the thing, of the censorship issues that we've been talking about, and the other was the data on the economics analysis. It turns out that Chairman Pai and the majority on the FCC were claiming that investment in telecommunications capital expenditures has fallen dramatically, at least has fallen since the net neutrality rule was adopted early in 2015. The New York Times and a number of other people have said that they had to cherry pick. Commissioner Clyburn had to they had to check their facts because virtually all the other data that you look at say pretty much the opposite.
So, you know, one thing that I should say is that you can respond to this effort to do away with net neutrality. Go to rfcm.org and you'll see what we sent in, and you need to respond to what Friends of Community Media's petition, not KK5, but our Friends of Community Media, rfcm.org.
Right. Okay, great. Thank you. Thank you, Tom. I'll give the wrap-up here. You've been listening to Gordon Elliott, Spencer Graves, and Tom Crane discussing the local primaries that will be held in the next two weeks, August 1st in Kansas, August 8th in Missouri, as well as net neutrality. This is 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Tom Crane is at the controls. The opinions you heard are those of the hosts and guests and do not reflect any official position of KKFI, the Midcoast Radio Project, its staff, or volunteers. Thank you for listening.